grandchildren. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is a test of the emergency alert system. If this were an actual emergency, the tones you just heard would be followed by information and further instructions. This concludes the test of the emergency alert system.
Support for KFEI comes from the Dakota, presenting Dominique Fiamme, Sunday, September 14th. Montreal-based singer-songwriter Dominique Fiamme places the history of African-American musical culture at the heart of her work. She reflects on the social realities that have influenced the blues, jazz, and soul. Her latest release is live at the Festival International des Jazz de Montréal. More information about Dominique Fiamme performing live at the Dakota can be found at dakotacooks.com.
Are you listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, or online at kfai.org, or so am I.
Yeah, me too.
Shouldn't everybody?
Miniculture is back for a brand new season.
I just think it's an interesting history and it should be told and people should know about it.
This season, we're sinking our teeth into Minnesota food history.
Long before there was Chipotle or Noodles & Company or Panera Bread or Jimmy John's, Leanne had quick service restaurants.
Exploring life and commerce along the Mississippi River.
It's kind of weird to think of water being grounding, but it is.
Meeting Minnesotans who have risked their lives to protect their fellow citizens.
He was basically a confidant, in effect, a person who the movers and shakers, where they felt comfortable.
And hearing many more stories from across the state.
Does anyone have any guesses what this is that we're paddling over right now?
I'm your host, John Gibertatios, and I can't wait for you to hear what we've got in store for you this season. Make sure you're subscribed to Miniculture wherever you get your podcasts. Season 9 premieres March 27th.
And that is what we have lined up for you today. This is Miniculture Presents. I am Michael Whetstone, and today we will be airing Episode 2 of the Miniculture Podcast Season 9. It is titled The Long Dark Shadow of Minnesota's Eugenic Sterilization Program from producer Matthew Schneeman. It is a very tough but important an interesting listen. You can subscribe to the award-winning Miniculture Podcast. You can also find these Miniculture Podcast episodes and their shorter stories at their SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture, or simply visit kfei.org and click on the Miniculture tab. If you missed last week's show, episode 1 called Ghost of the Upper Mississippi River about Meeker Dam from new producer Lydia Moran, be sure to check that out too. But for now, here is the Miniculture Podcast, Season 9, Episode 2, The Long Dark Shadow of Minnesota's Eugenic Sterilization Program from producer Matthew Schneeman.
Welcome to Miniculture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. The term eugenics might make you think of Nazi Germany, a racist pseudoscientific ideology from long, long ago, and far, far away from Minnesota. But in the early 20th century, Minnesota had its own eugenics program, one that sterilized over 2,000 people. The impact of this program was enormous, and it is still being felt today. by the families of the people who were subjected to it. Today, producer Matthew Schneeman follows one family's journey through this dark period in Minnesota history.
In 1926, two representatives from the Minnesota Board of Control visited Mary DeShane's home in Bemidji. A year before, her daughter had been forcibly committed to the Faribault State School. The Faribault State School wasn't actually a school, but an institution that housed people that were declared feeble-minded. The two representatives, a male and a female, told Mary that they wanted to send Rose home, but there was a catch. They would send her home only if Mary agreed, on Rose's behalf, to Rose being sterilized. And Rose's case wasn't unique.
And so Minnesota started sterilizing these women. And it was a get-out-of-jail-free card. Once you were sterilized, they released you.
This is journalist John Erickson. He wrote a book called When Mortals Play God. Rose DeShane was John's grandmother. But she didn't have all of her rights yet, so they had to ask Mary, your great-grandmother, if she was okay with it.
Well, right. She, it was a chance to get her out of the institution and into the home.
And so, Mary agreed to her daughter's sterilization. Sterilization being the price of freedom, as one report for the American Neurological Association's Committee for the Investigation of Sterilization phrased it. It was supposed to be the end of something. The end of her daughter's forced commitment at the state institution. But it would echo throughout John Erickson's family for generations. Between 1925 and 1945, the state of Minnesota eugenically sterilized 2,204 people, 77% women. Eugenics is a racist, ableist pseudoscience that believes that some races are genetically superior or inferior to other races. And so, eugenic sterilization is when you sterilize a person to keep their genes from mixing with future generations. But John Erickson didn't set out to write a book on eugenics. At first, he was just trying to help his mother, Millie.
Really came about by accident.
John had done some genealogy research on his wife's family. They had discovered a lost relative.
And my mom was listening to the story, and she said, oh, why don't you find my brother?
A long-lost uncle for John.
So I started trying to find him, and it took me on this journey about how eugenics had impacted my mother's family, and it impacted them in a big way.
Rose grew up in Brainerd, Minnesota, one of nine kids.
There were a lot of kids. Brainerd was kind of it was sort of a melting pot. There was a lot of industry there. And they had a big family. And Rose was she was a troubled kid from the beginning. She was basically kicked out of school when she was in, third grade. She was 8 years old.
She kept getting sent home from school for things like, at one point, she, sat backwards to, annoy the teachers.
Yeah, she was just, kind of a wild child. And it was long before special education took hold in this country, and there just wasn't the infrastructure to handle kids like her.
As Rose got into her teens, things didn't improve.
She was uneducated and grew up in a really poor household, and so she struck out on her own and got into all kinds of trouble.
Well, before that, can you tell me her relationship with Lottie?
Well, Lottie was her older sister. Lottie, I think, was 10 years older than her, and she kind of took her under her wing a little bit.
Lottie was an anchor for Rose. John writes, Lottie worked with Rose on her reading and took her along on shopping trips, introducing her as my sis. When someone is different, as Rose most certainly was, others often act as if that person will leave a bruise if you get too close. Lottie wasn't like that, end quote.
It was kind of a cold day in March, and she was trying to revive the fire in the fireplace, and it exploded. And she was holding her baby, and both of them died.
And then tragedy befell Rose's other sister, Ida.
She died in childbirth.
And that was within a year?
within like 8 months. So Rose lost two sisters within 8 months, and it was a really traumatic time for the family and came at a time when she was becoming a young woman. It had a huge impact on her.
Rose got a bad reputation. She drank, she had sex for money. She was living an immoral life, as they would determine it.
She was committed the first time because two people said she was immoral.
Yeah.
And that's all it took.
And that's how she was forcibly committed to the Faribault State School. Getting someone committed could be shockingly unfair.
In some cases, you only need the husband to say that his wife was immoral or feeble-minded. And, you know, in these rural communities, it was felt that you could, if you committed someone, you would take the problem away. And so they got the problem out of Brainerd. But what I tried to point out is that, A, the problem didn't go away, and B, you know, just in impact Rose, it impacted this and her entire family and really generations after that.
By the time Rose was committed, a couple things had to have happened. The main one was the 1917 Children's Code had to be passed. That was a large collection of bills that were meant to improve childhood welfare, destigmatizing children born out of wedlock, and expanding the safety net for families in poverty. Pretty good idea, right? However, a couple eugenicists got involved and pushed for some things to be added to the bill, the ability for the state to forcibly commit anyone deemed feeble-minded to a state facility. It was related to the Children's Code because if a parent was not able to take care of their kid, then why not leave it up to a doctor or judge to remove the parent to get the children help? The problem was how subjective and biased those decisions ended up being. That's how it made it possible for Rose to be locked up to a state facility, even though she had committed no crime and wasn't a threat to herself or others. But before eugenics made the leap from an idea to being written into law, before Rose got institutionalized for being quote-unquote feeble-minded, before all that, eugenics had to be accepted by the public. And one bizarre place where that happened was the Minnesota State Fair, where in 1913, 14, 15, and 1920, a eugenic competition called the Better Babies Contest took place. I talked to two disability historians about this strange event, Sarah Palicki and Laura LePink. Here's Laura.
And I guess my personal connection to the Minnesota State Fair is that I grew up about, like, you know, 3-4 blocks away from the State Fair.
Do they give people that live really close by free admission?
They do not, unfortunately.
Oh, come on, they should.
And that's Sarah. Together, they researched and wrote a digital exhibit about those fair years for Repair Disability Heritage Collective's website, repairhistory.org. A public history collective that focuses on interpreting and mapping place-based disability histories. What would people have seen when they went to the women's building where they were having the Better Babies Contest?
There is an amazing description in a Minnesota newspaper.
That's Sarah Palicki.
Quote, "The contest was conducted in a glass cage, 20 by 20, in the center of the women's building.
Babies would be judged to see how eugenically pure or great they were.
Three sides were of glass, the fourth side opening into two dressing rooms. Each baby was examined in full view of the public. The physicians and the nurses in their white uniforms were the only ones allowed in this cage." End quote.
The Better Babies Contest, or the Baby Health Contest, was part of a larger nationwide movement called Fitter Families. It wasn't really a contest. It was more an exhibition. Yeah, and I think A.C. Rogers, the superintendent at the Faribault School, he was the judge. Is that correct at one point? Laura LePink?
Yeah, so A.C. Rogers was there.
Dr. A.C. Rogers was a proponent of eugenics. And how did he judge the babies? Well, based on, quote, "the shape of the ears, of the underjaw, racial angles, asymmetry of any kind," end quote.
But one of the other people who is, like, kind of better known for doing these contests was Dr. Frederick Coleman. He served as the director of research at the Faribault School for the Feeble-Minded.
John Erickson says Coleman actually authorized one of Rose's intelligence tests.
And he also served as the president of the American Association of Mental Deficiency. And so he was like very much involved. And we actually have like a news article that shows him, you know, assessing a baby at the fair. So he was very much a part of it. But he was also at an institution that carried out a significant number of the sterilizations that happened in Minnesota.
But it wasn't just male medical elites who were into eugenics. In fact, here's Sarah again.
The contest at the state fair was housed in the women's building.
Women were associated with a particular branch of eugenics called euthenics. It was kind of seen as scientific parenting.
Which was, I think, the goal of Bertha Dahl Laws.
Bertha Dahl Laws, and that's her name, Dahl Laws. She was a lecturer and had a wide-ranging resume, and she presided over the public welfare department at the state fair.
Although she did object to it being in among displays of sewing and jams and jellies and the like, because she did feel that that diminished the Better Babies contest's importance. But having the contest there and showing primarily women, but parents more generally, both how to tend to your baby and also how to assess your baby on like a spectrum of the quote-unquote eugenic baby to the quote-unquote defective baby.
Women were very involved in the eugenics movement. But earlier on, it looked different than what we think of eugenics as today. In 1926, the magazine The Farmer's Wife published an article that asked farm women what they wanted in daily life. And they responded, quote, more libraries, better movies, a bank account. And a couple paragraphs later, they talk about the Fitter Families program, which was a eugenic program. Eugenics at the time was lumped into general self-improvement and a progressive vision of health and modernity. The Fitter Families program promoted proper nutrition and plenty of sleep, things that don't really sound quite like eugenics. Yet, to people like Bertha Dahl Laws, it was all part of the same movement.
She, in many ways, was arguing that women had a stake in the eugenics movement through the domain of motherhood and by being able to control the environment that babies were brought up in, and that this would result in quote-unquote better babies.
Yeah, but that's weird because that's just parenting, isn't it?
you would think.
Maybe this comparison can help. This direction of eugenics, kind of sounds like wellness culture. People leaning into the most recent science to try to be as healthy and fit as they can be. You know, oh, you need to eat more fiber, magnesium, antioxidants, sleep cycles, Fitbits, glucose monitors, no sugar, paleo diet, vegan diet, biohacking. All of it is in service of optimizing and becoming an ideal human. Women like Bertha Dahl Laws were more interested in that side of eugenics, euthenics. It was a more malleable form of perfecting humankind. Perhaps this is because women were more involved in raising kids and seeing that how you treat someone, what you feed them, influences who they become. But the male leaders of eugenics were convinced the perfection of humankind was simpler. Genes. Specifically Charles Dyte, the founder of the Minnesota Eugenics Society. And guess what? He was also at the fair. He wrote about his observations just as a spectator in a letter to the editor for the Minneapolis Daily Star. There's a quote where he's like walking through the fair and he's walking through the livestock. And then he says something like,
yes, it's the Holstein cattle quote. In the livestock exhibit at the Minnesota State Fair, a scrub cow is placed beside two fine Holstein cattle for contrast and to show that by wise selection and breeding, a superior stock can certainly be produced that will yield more and better milk and increase the farmer's income. A question which I asked several exhibitors of stock and which always caused a smile was this: where on the fairgrounds is the building in which is exhibited a fine type and superior strain of human beings, purebred men and women, human thoroughbreds?
Charles Dyte was popular at the time, though he was found to be annoying to lawmakers. There's a story of lawmakers running out the backs of buildings when they saw him coming. But other people liked him. He published a lot of op-eds. He even had a street named after him.
But he was, I guess, influential in early public hygiene initiatives, things like ranging from garbage removal to like pasteurization of milk as a standard. Things that seem fairly innocuous.
Quit while you're ahead, Dyke. Why do you have to keep going?
But now he's known for his full-throated embrace of eugenics. His answer to the Great Depression, eugenics. Here's Sarah.
Quote, we have in the United States approximately 6 million socially unfit people who should not reproduce their kind. They are in the feeble-minded, insane, epileptic, and criminal classes. To prevent their multiplication is next in importance to getting out of this depression.
He mused about a science fiction future where you could remove a morally superior woman's ovaries, suspend it in a glass jar, and monthly harvest her eggs to create hundreds of genetically superior babies. He wrote to Adolf Hitler in 1933.
I enclose a clipping from the Minneapolis Journal of Minnesota, United States of America, relating to and praising your plan to stamp out mental inferiority among the German people. I trust you will accept my sincere wish that your effort along that line will be a great success and will advance the eugenics movement in other nations as well as Germany.
Dyte was an eccentric, fear-mongering man. He no longer has a street named after him. In 2022, after a petition from Minneapolis residents, Dyte Avenue was renamed after John Cheatham, the city's first black fire captain. From the extreme eugenicists like Dyte, who embodied the fears of eugenics, to people like Bertha Dahl Laws, who embraced the allure of euthenics, many Minnesotans internalized the pseudoscience. It could be seen as only a matter of time until these ideas made their way into law. First, the Children's Code of 1917 that allowed for the forced commitment of people deemed feeble-minded, and then in 1925 when eugenic sterilization was legalized in Minnesota. On August 12, 1924, because of that legislation, Rose DeShane was forcibly institutionalized at the Faribault State School.
And so Rose has been committed. How much did you get to learn about her time in the documents or archival research of what was going on when she was there?
Very little. There was one instance where she tried to run away and she was very pregnant at the time, so I don't think she could have gotten very far.
Rose wasn't the only person who tried to escape. In 1939, a woman named Blanche Harkner climbed out of a window at the Faribault State School and tried to escape a scheduled sterilization. She fell 2.5 floors, breaking both of her legs and hurting her spine. But what was daily life like at the Faribault State School? There was a wide range of people there. A woman referred to as MD, who was born prematurely and needed care. There was Jeannie, a child whose growth was halted due to a malfunctioning pituitary gland and couldn't move much or speak. After treating her thyroid, she recovered greatly. There were people who needed care and often got it, like Jeannie. But also, the staff was often overwhelmed and resorted to punishment and isolation, as happened with the woman referred to as C, who would swallow things, exhibit schizophrenia-like symptoms, be sexually inappropriate, and cause disruptions. There also were people who were capable of most active daily living skills, but just couldn't live independently. Assistant physician A.R.T. Wiley described some of the daily activities people would do. He said, quote, the girls can do basketry, make raffia, and reed baskets. They can embroider. And the boys can learn broom making, the whole process. They can do woodwork, where accuracy in following a design is involved, end quote. The school had similarities to day programs or group homes that we have now, places where people with special needs can go to learn skills, do work, and be in community. However, for many, it wasn't a school or hospital, but a prison. And this is where Rose was for about 2 years before, in 1926, she was sterilized. Mary agreed to it, and Rose was sent home. But it wasn't the end of her problems. Rose returned home and was reunited with her kids, Ernie the oldest, Millie, John's mom, and Robert, who was just an infant at the time. But the reunion didn't last long. Rose's mom had remarried after her husband Joe died, and her new husband...
He turned out not to be a very good guy and ran off with her three children.
He kind of kidnapped Rose and her children, took off.
And he was pulled over, or somehow he got caught near the Canadian border.
So what was he picked up for up by the Canadian border?
Not sure. Okay. Not sure. I mean, I don't know what the crime was. I mean, it was just kind of a violation of her parole, I guess.
She had a record of being labeled feeble-minded shouldn't be out in the community, it sounds like. And so Rose was institutionalized again, and it was deemed that Mary wasn't fit to take care of the grandkids.
Yeah, so the kids ended up in the orphanage, and it wasn't a great place.
They were sent to St. James Orphanage in Duluth. In recent years, adults who lived at the orphanage have come out to claim sexual abuse by priests while staying there.
Wasn't a great place, and I suspect it wasn't a great place when my mom and her two brothers were there.
While her kids were at St. James Orphanage, Rose spent four more years at Faribault and other institutions, one being a kind of halfway house, a group home where women were supervised while they worked as housekeepers out in the community. At one job, she met a man, a nice man by all accounts, and those in charge thought that was a good thing, so they allowed her to marry him, which meant she could be released.
And was she released because she had this, like, male husband who wasn't, quote-unquote, feeble-minded?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The first time Rose got her freedom was by giving up her reproductive rights, and the second time she was released was only because she was considered safe, now under the guardianship of a man.
Well, the name of the government body that oversaw all this was called the Board of Control.
Oh, yes.
Which was a very apt name.
However, during all this, one of Rose's kids was put up for adoption. This was Robert, the lost brother John was looking for when he started this project. His mother, Millie, wasn't put up for adoption because she had rickets. Her older brother, Ernie, was too old and had behavioral issues.
Right. And you know, I mean, adoption is a wonderful thing for many people, but with everything that happened in the family, I just believe that in this case, it wasn't good that Robert was separated from my mother, Millie.
John said that this loss affected his mother her whole life.
My grandmother, she lost her mother when she was very young. And my mom told me that my grandmother, never got over it.
Yeah.
I think maybe that connection of, like, no matter how old you get, some of those things are kind of, like, carved in you.
Yeah, I think time heals a lot of wounds, but, you know, the wound is still there, and you don't forget. I mean, you move on, but you don't forget.
We are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI. Today we are airing episode 2 from season 9 of the Mini Culture podcast. We will continue to air our story from Matthew Schneeman right after these messages.
This is Miguel Vargas, Program Director of Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI. Congress has voted to zero out the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, eliminating funding KFAI relies on to help covering operating costs and music licensing fees that allow us to play the music you love. In the past, KFAI has weathered challenges by staying close to our mission. Everyone deserves access to media that reflects who they are. We also believe in community ownership of the airwaves. We share joy, we speak the truth, while connecting community through our wave of sound. Now we need our community to help carry us through. Please start a monthly gift today or increase what you gave earlier this year. Go to KFAI.org to donate. With your help, we can continue broadcasting as Fresh Air Community Radio. Thank you.
Support for KFAI comes from Crooner Supper Club, presenting Alma and Dina Wednesday, September 24th. For over 15 years, Alma and Dina has combined traditional South American instruments with Latin rhythms such as cumbia, salsa, folk, guajira, Latin rock, reggae, and other styles. With a diverse lineup of members from Chile, Mexico, Puerto Rico, and the USA, Alma Andina brings a mix of musical flavors and invites the community to feel unified and represented by their always evolving diversity. More information about Alma Andina at Crooner Supper Club is available at croonersmn.com.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Radio Without Boundaries. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This is Mini Culture Presents here on KFAI. My name is Mike Whetstone, and we are listening to a episode of Mini Culture Podcast from Season 9 titled The Long Dark Shadow of Minnesota's Eugenic Sterilization Program from producer Matthew Schneeman. We will now continue with our story.
One of the biggest disruptions, if not the biggest, in John's family story was not the sterilization of Rose, but the forced adoption of Robert. Forced adoption and sterilizations were not uncommon in Minnesota at the time, especially for Native American people.
Now, there's certainly evidence that Indigenous people were sterilized.
This is Molly Ladd-Taylor, a historian who has written about Minnesota's eugenic sterilization program.
Particularly after the war, in the 60s and the 1970s, there was a crisis of sterilization abuse in Indian Health Service hospitals. We absolutely know that.
But because of funding reasons, specifically that Native people were under the auspices of the federal government, not the state, they weren't targeted in Minnesota's eugenic sterilization program.
In terms of this earlier period of eugenic sterilization, which is what I was writing about, I didn't find a targeted campaign.
Which may sound odd, since eugenics is usually thought of as a race-based discrimination. But the target of the eugenic sterilization program in Minnesota was mostly poor white people, often Scandinavian and German Americans, ethnicities usually lauded by eugenicists as being pure. But Minnesota's eugenic sterilization program didn't focus on non-white Minnesotans, partly because at the time, Minnesota's population was overwhelmingly white. But also, as Molly Ladd-Taylor points out, in Minnesota, poverty was the target.
The sterilization law was written by the State Board of Control. It was really written as a welfare law, and it was introduced by the Public Welfare Committee.
Poverty and lessening welfare costs was one of the main focuses of the 1925 bill that legalized eugenic sterilization. William Mayo, one of the founders of the Mayo Clinic, claimed in 1923, a couple years before the bill, that poverty was, quote, to a large extent, hereditary, end quote. And eugenic sterilization could be a solution to that. He also said that one goal of public hospitals should be to, quote, reduce the number of people whom it must care for at the expense of the taxpayer, end quote. Another connection linking the motivations of Minnesota's eugenic sterilization program to anti-poverty discrimination. But how did it work on the ground floor, though? Who was making the decisions, declaring people feeble-minded or not?
Who did the compulsory commitment or institutionalization? That was a probate judge. And so, as you can imagine, compulsory commitment or institutionalization became completely bound up with questions of electoral politics and local community conflict. If you had a pastor or you were an affluent person in the town, it was easier to get off for the same behaviors that if you were from a family that was considered disreputable or you were an unmarried mother, then, you know, the compulsory commitment law was a good way to get rid of people who were considered troublemakers in the community.
Mm, the exact type of person that Rose Deschain, John Erickson's grandmother, was.
Exactly. Or Rose's case is a perfect example of there would have been so many points in her history and her children's history where the state could have helped her and helped her children, but they didn't. They removed her children. You know, they institutionalized them, they institutionalized her, sterilized her, you know, you can think about what a different child welfare system might have meant for some, for Rose and her children and ultimately her grandchildren.
Molly Ladd Taylor argues that when the Depression hit and smaller towns found themselves needing to save money, they found it convenient to label someone feeble-minded and have them shipped off to a state institution. And we see that the numbers go up when the Great Depression hits. But Molly also points out that it wasn't just anti-poverty discrimination.
Part of it is sexism, because how the girls who came before the juvenile court were treated was very different from how the boys were came before the court were treated. Oftentimes the girls were in trouble for what were considered moral or sexual questions, oftentimes running around with boys. It's like the boys weren't even there in terms of the way the court would treat the girls.
When it came to the feeble-minded designation, men were a problem if they were violent, but women were a problem if they were sexual. But also,
another part of the story of sterilization and of feeble-mindedness, the so-called diagnosis of this, a lot of it is there was quite a bit of sexual abuse, some incest, and, you know, the mistreatment of young girls and some boys, but we have more documentation of the girls because they were the ones who became pregnant. That's also part of the story.
You have the example of Edna Collins. I think you wrote that the main symptom of her feeble-mindedness was after a 50-year-old man molested her when she was 9 or 10 years old.
Yeah, she was 18 when she was sterilized, I believe. She's a perfect example, and there are many, many others. One of the really heartbreaking ones that I think of is a woman, Lucille Johnson, and she had two, quote, illegitimate children by her father and her brother. And she was institutionalized. One of her children was taken away, the other died. What a lot of loss. This poor young woman should have been cared for with compassion, but that's not what happened to her. When we look at how somebody like Rose would be diagnosed as feeble-minded, you know, we have to look at the trauma that she experienced in her life.
After Rose got married, after she got a respectable male guardian, she was released and got her two kids back, Millie, John's mom, and Ernie. She settled down a bit, but the problems didn't go away. There were problems that existed before Rose was institutionalized, that of poverty, that of alcoholism. John Erickson again.
One of her big problems, maybe the major problem, is she was an alcoholic. Yet I don't know that she ever got any treatment for alcoholism while she was in the institution. So I just think that the kind of help she needed just wasn't given to her.
And then there were the problems that resulted because of her institutionalization, the breakup of her family, the possible childhood abuse while the kids were at the orphanage. These things made life hard.
My mom describes her as being a very hard woman. She was not a good mother. She doted on her oldest son, Ernie.
Who knows why she doted on Ernie so much? Maybe it was because they had similar lives. Both Rose and Ernie were institutionalized when they were young. Rose was committed for being immoral. Ernie was put in prison for 4 years because of a robbery. His anger followed him his whole life until it ended tragically.
Yeah, Ernie was, you know, a very troubled guy. The story I told in the book, he ended up shooting up a courtroom in Portland, Oregon, and killing an attorney before killing himself. He tried to kill the judge, tried to kill his wife.
Both Rose and Ernie had a hard time dealing with life and had a hard time raising their kids.
Rose wasn't a very good mother, and he wasn't a very good father.
Ernie left behind a son, Michael. He seemed like a pretty troubled person. John writes of a story where he splashed gasoline on his mother.
And then acting like he was going to light a match and set her on fire.
Yeah.
He was a sociopath and just a really, really bad individual. Michael tried to blow up a pair of restaurants in Astoria, Oregon, and the bombs didn't go off the way he wanted them to. So then he killed himself in front of all kinds of people. Pretty tragic history.
Yeah. To me, when I hear these stories, all I can see are the counterfactuals. What if Rose hadn't been committed? What if the kids hadn't been sent to an orphanage? For Ernie in particular, would that have helped?
She was poor, but it was a household full of love. And he certainly did not have that in the orphanage.
A lot of what ifs.
Well, as I tried to point out in the book, childhood experiences matter. And we don't know if none of this would happen. Would Ernie have gone into a courtroom and with a gun? You know, there's no way to know that. But I do know from my mother felt she had kind of a hole from being separated from her younger brother. And even that he was separated from Ernie, because Ernie went on to live a pretty tragic life.
And what about Robert, his mom's long-lost little brother? John did end up finding him, but unfortunately, he died in 93. And more unfortunately, it sounds like he didn't have that great of a life. He struggled with alcoholism. Again, more unanswerable questions.
Would he have been better off if he had never been adopted and had gone back with Rose? We have no way of knowing that. I do think that he might have been helped by knowing my mother. I think everybody who ever met her was helped by that.
John's mother was able to have a wonderfully unremarkable, happy, normal life. She loved her kids, her kids' kids. When she was younger, she traveled out west with her stepfather, Orville. And when she saw the Pacific Ocean, she wrote in her journal, "If I lived there, I'm sure most of my time would be spent out there fishing." With the childhood she had, how did she end up so okay? Well, some people just get lucky, I think. But also,
she said, told me once that she has no memory of even seeing her own mother in the first 10 years of her life. And so those first 10 years of her life, she spent in her grandmother's house. And her grandmother must have done something right because, you know, my mom was a wonderful woman.
And then one last really big what if. If Rose would have been sterilized before she had had Millie, John's mom, well then, none of you would be here.
Yeah, that's true. That's a terrible thought. Yeah.
Wipes you out of existence.
Right. Well, and that's really, and I don't think that thought was given to the people who adopted this practice. I don't think they thought about the ramifications of it.
There are so many factors that went into Minnesota's eugenic sterilization program. It was a rapidly changing period and landscape. Eugenics as an ideology influenced how people thought. Industrialization created wealth, but also created poverty. It changed and uprooted how communities took care of people who were poor. But underneath all of this was something simple, elemental, that got lost. This last story is about a different Rose. Not Rose DeShane, but
Rose Masters.
Historian Molly Ladd-Taylor again.
She was an important case in that went to the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1944. She was the wife of a tenant farmer, and they had a bunch of kids in the Depression. They were followed by the Child Welfare Board because they thought they had too many kids and they couldn't support them. You know, her house wasn't clean enough, and, you know, the bread, they didn't cut the bread properly.
Really? That was a detail they had?
Yeah, the bread was just torn off. You know, it wasn't cut properly, and the kids looked, you know, didn't look properly dressed and sometimes missed school. And then the Child Welfare Board arranges for her to be institutionalized with the plan to sterilize her, but they're Catholic, so they object.
The church was against sterilization in principle, but what was more important was who objected right next door.
But the neighbors really objected, and there was a big brouhaha, and the neighbor said, "You got to be kidding. You know, she's not a, okay, we'll admit she's not the best housekeeper, but she is a good mother." And the case went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court and said something to the effect of, just because a woman in this day of age of birth control has a large family doesn't make her a moron.
It wasn't a complete victory, however. She still had to fight to get her kids back. But it was a repudiation of the eugenic sterilization program. But in order for the Minnesota Supreme Court to repudiate that program, the neighbors had to first.
The neighbors really rallied to her defense, and that obviously made a really big difference for the court.
There's a lot of top-down pressure that led to people being eugenically sterilized in Minnesota. There was a medical elite class that believed in the pseudoscience, and there was a bureaucratic state that allowed for it. But in the case of Rose Masters, when her neighbors came out for her, she was helped. But for Rose DeShane, she wasn't as well liked. And two neighbors testified that she was a, quote, common prostitute, and she was branded feeble-minded and lost her rights. Most of these cases started with the choice that Minnesotans made back then, wanting to condemn someone, get rid of them, or wanting to help them. They helped Rose Masters. It's a shame Rose DeShane didn't have that help. It's really hard. I'm sorry that it's part of your family story.
Well, we survived.
This episode was written and produced by Matthew Schneeman. Special thanks to Molly Ladd-Taylor for her research, additional help, and for her introduction to John Erickson. Mini Culture is a production of KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sensulo. More episodes are coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed to Mini Culture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. For many Minnesota athletes, it's all about the distance. From runners who take on the Twin Cities or Duluth Marathons, to cross-country skiers who traverse 50 kilometers for the American Birkebeiner in Wisconsin. There's something special about a long-distance race and the communities that these races attract. Just a few weeks ago, a 100-kilometer ski race was added to the Midwest's long list of long-distance races. The Ski North Ultra Marathon, which happened in early March, is a 62-mile cross-country ski course. KFAI's Paul Broha set off with a crew of assistant producers to watch the first Ski North Ultra and to meet some of the people who spent their whole day skiing through the woods in northern Minnesota.
How are you guys feeling?
Excited for a day in the woods.
Yeah, it should be great. Yeah, it should be fun, you know?
They have some moose tracks out there.
Really?
We saw moose tracks around the 40K mark. Oh, here
we go! It's a Saturday morning, early March, on Minnesota's north shore of Lake Superior. 71 skiers just left the starting area near some campsites at Cascade River State Park. The snow is actually too thin in this area to mechanically groom the trails. It's been thawing and freezing. It's crusty. No one seems to mind.
How do you feel?
Oh, really good.
We're doing great, actually.
Pure joy.
Just a few days before this 100-kilometer Ski North Ultra Marathon, race director Allie Ricken wasn't quite sure if the full course would be skiable or if the race would even actually happen. A late-season dump of snow in the Twin Cities completely missed the North Shore, but the little snow there was at Cascade River just barely held out on the rocky trails. And Allie got friends and family to patch up some of the dicey parts with shovels and pickaxes.
So you're saying there is some snow out there?
Yep. It is starting to melt, though.
You think it'll stay enough for tomorrow's race?
Hopefully.
That's my sweetheart, Ingrid, speaking with Allie's daughter, Rosemary, while her dad was chipping ice off some wooden steps. All of my kids are here, too. Ingrid's skiing in the race, and Allie is a good friend of ours. She talked to me earlier about some of the adventurous aspects of this course.
when I was originally planning this, I got a good chuckle because it says, you know, ski trail across the waterfall bridge. But then I went there. There's stairs. So that's a walk across. People will have to take their skis off unless they really want to go for it.
Bring your stair skis.
That would wreck your skis.
The night before the race, Allie went over the maps with some of her volunteers.
If you go a little bit further straight, you'll run into a loop that should, it's not groomed, but it hopefully looks like a skiable situation.
Saturday morning started at about 14 degrees, which made for some great beardicles on the folks with facial hair and frozen eyelashes all around. I caught up with the pack about 10 kilometers in at the first rest stop.
How's the traffic coming?
It's pretty good, yeah. I think by this point it's a little more relaxed.
It started to snow and felt like a Christmas card as skiers disappeared up the narrow trail with just one set of ski tracks. This race was set up to finish mostly in the daylight. That's a little less than 12 hours at this time of the year. But over 100 kilometers, or 62 miles, that can mean the fastest ones will come in 3 or 4 hours before the ones at the end. People started to stretch out at the third rest stop. One person cheerfully munched on a cardamom bun while some medics patched up her bloody knee. She said she crashed into a rotten log. The next bit of excitement on the trail was back at the fabled footbridge, some 30 feet above the rocks and ice of the Cascade River.
We're going to try to catch up with some skiers making their way across the bridge. Liam, take it from here.
All right, Raven.
That's my son, Raven, talking with his friend, Liam.
Hey, I'm Liam here with KVI, just wondering how you're feeling about the race.
All right, how about you? Having fun out?
Yeah. How are you feeling?
This sucks, but
how's it going?
Let's go!
Hey, 13K.
How's the snow looking?
The snow, it snowed! And people were delighted.
That last one there was Ingrid, our skiing reporter. This race also had 25-kilometer and 50-kilometer events. And by the middle of the day, those racers started intermingling on the trails with the 100-kilometer skiers. Raven and Liam and my other son, Tamarack, migrated up the hill to a little clearing in the woods where the shorter races started to finish on a sunny downhill that looked a bit like a mountain bike trail. They were lured into announcing results.
Go, Molly!
Mollyos!
Louder.
Let's go, Molly!
Here comes Molly.
124.
124. Katia!
Let's go get an interview. Oh, he's gone.
Okay, we are here at the finish line. You know, we got some spectators gathered around. It's been a little bit slow. Usually it's been around 10 minutes between people that are finishing the race.
Liam caught up with the winner of the 50-kilometer race, Kenneth Rip.
It seemed like it was going to start as like a real adventure race because of this section, this last section, and then having to take your skis off and run over the ice. That was really exciting.
Yep.
And then once we got on the track and then the snow started coming down, it was gorgeous and just skiing by, just serene out there.
For the other racers, temperatures started climbing and it made the fresh layer of snow start to stick to the bottom of lots of skis. This was a classic only race, not a skate skiing race, which means you ski in a running motion in parallel tracks, theoretically. It's March in Minnesota, so you ski on whatever surface you can find. About 2:30 in the now sunny afternoon, race director Allie Ricken was at the last major intersection where the racers either turned left to finish or went straight to do another 20-kilometer section.
I was just reading all the people that are, like, still unaccounted for.
Oh, how many are you missing?
Oh, no, I'm on the radio. Oh, a handful, but I...
Well, I'm sure they'll turn up.
They'll turn up. And if not, we'll go find them. Oh, here comes a skier. All right, Louis!
Straight ahead. You guys, straight ahead.
Where's the finish?
That way.
We reckoned our skiing reporter, Ingrid, should be coming up on about 80 kilometers at this point. I decided to ski up the hill to see if I could find her. I saw the skier with the bloody knee looking strong at about 79 kilometers. It really does feel like we're in the mountains here, the way the sun hits the snow and the pine trees. Woo! All right.
Yay!
Final lap or one more?
No, we're done, man. All right. Kick
us out. So the weather, the sunlight, the snow, the feeling in the air, is that this should be a nice closing touch to the day, but some people still have to do this last 20-kilometer loop one more time, including this person. Oh, no?
You have to stay with me.
That recorder is faster than this one.
Well, Ingrid did finish a couple hours later, about 30 minutes after dark, and just before a snowmobile sweeper came through. She was number 52 out of the 52 who finished, ages 16 through 63. The finish line scene was dark, maybe 10 people standing in the forest with headlamps, smiling, and expressing other emotions.
Oh my gosh, I feel like that should have been like easier than it was or something. Like my everything, I'm not gonna be able to walk tomorrow, you guys.
Well, you did just ski 62 miles. With reporting assistance from Raven Broha, Liam McNiff, Tamrak Broha, and Ingrid Remack, for KFAI, I'm Paul Broha, Cascade River State Park, Minnesota.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE.
Earlier in the program, we heard episode 2 of the Miniculture podcast from season 9. That was from Minnesota producer Matthew Schneeman, titled The Long Dark Shadow of Minnesota's Eugenic Sterilization Program. Be sure to tune in next week for episode 3, The Minnesota Woman Who Helped Eradicate Tuberculosis in Minnesota, from producer Allison Young. Until then, thank you again for tuning in to Miniculture Presents here on KFAI. This is Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support for Miniculture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Coming up next, The Upside Down.
Come and defend what you saw. Got to be back today.